MechCast, Wednesday, December 19th, 2012. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, another week or so has gone by, and we have a lot of Mac news and things to discuss. Specifically, it looks like the Apple TV may be a little bit more delayed than some first thought, or at least some first hoped. The Mac Mini is set to be probably the most popular iPad in history, and we've got some rumors about Apple moving into processors. That, along with all of your questions, hints, tips, and tricks, we'll get to all of that in just a moment. But before we get started, I want to take a second and thank one of our show sponsors, actually a new sponsor here on the MacCast, and that is Code 42. They make a backup service called CrashPlan. It's actually the backup service I've been using for years. And, you know, we store a ton of data. Actually, according to Gartner Research, 464 gigabytes per household in 2012. And the reality is that most people don't do backup. And I know MacCast listeners are probably the exception to that rule. But even those people who back up, I think a critical piece that is often left out is offsite backup. So you need protection not just from hard drive failure, but also from things like theft or disaster. And that's really where CrashPlan comes in. And when I was comparing services, I just found that CrashPlan had all the bases covered. They let you back up across their multiple global data centers. You can back up to external devices or even to a friend's computer. And it's a continuous backup. So it's always running, it's always backing up, but it does it in a really smart way. It actually backs up your most recent files first, which is really helpful when you're using online backup. You know that your critical stuff is going to get backed up immediately, and then it'll go back and get your older files. You can also decide how it uses your CPU and network resources, which is really handy, and you can tweak it however you'd like, including taking into consideration things like battery life and more. It saves different versions of your files, and it uses a really sophisticated method for doing that. It uses byte pattern analysis and data deduplication techniques to detect changes in your files, and allows you to keep multiple versions of files using less CPU bandwidth and storage. They also have mobile apps for iOS, Android, and Windows, which means that you're going to be able to get access to your files anywhere that you need them. And not only that, it's not just access to your entire backup, but also the different versions of your files as well on mobile. Some of my favorite features personally are that I can set up backups for both internal and external drives, something that not all services provide. And you can selectively define what you want backed up. You can do whole volumes, folders, files, whatever you want, and you can get really granular so that you're backing up just the critical files you need and not a lot of extra stuff, so that you're not, again, eating up your bandwidth or your storage online. And it's secure. The data is secured before it even leaves your machine. They use data key encryption before transmission, and while it's being transmitted, they use 128-bit encrypted communication. The other thing I really like is that they have realistic and affordable plans, including a family plan that offers unlimited storage and multiple computers. So the reality is you can basically get online storage, unlimited storage for all of your computers at a cost that's less than an external hard drive. So if you've been holding off on finding an online backup solution, you need to go now to CrashPlan.com. They have a free 30-day trial available. I've been using the software for years. I can tell you it just works, and it's amazing, and I'm so glad to have them as a sponsor of the MacCast. It's been a couple years now that we've been hearing about Apple producing their own HD TV set, and it still seems like it's going to happen someday, just not anytime soon, at least according to recent rumors this week. The Wall Street Journal reported that Apple supposedly is currently testing multiple designs of a TV set with its Asian suppliers, but don't get too excited. They say it's not an official project yet. It's likely that what we're hearing about is just early prototypes, and the Wall Street Journal rightly points out that Apple does this with their various Asian partners very often without even committing to manufacturing. So they're just playing around with different designs and sets. as far as who they're working with. It sounds like it's Han High Precision, and that they are working with Sharp to design these early prototype versions of Apple's TV set. I think interest in the Apple HD TV is getting more feverish now because everybody's looking to see what Apple's next big thing is going to be. Also, Tim Cook in his NBC interview recently did quote-unquote upgrade Apple's TV efforts from a hobby to what he said was an area of intense interest. While Apple may be working out some of the firm details and ideas about hardware, software, and functionality, though, that's really just half the battle. It's probably more likely that what's slowing down Apple moving forward is the content, the deals that they have to do with the various producers, creators, and distributors of the content. Those things aren't easy, and I think Apple is having an easier time with the hardware, putting that into different designs and testing, but it's going to be a while before we see something come through. They still have a lot of work ahead of them, and I'm not sure they're ready to jump in fully to that program, and I think that's what Cook was alluding to in that interview. So I am excited to think about what Apple might do in the TV realm. At the same time, I'm pretty conservative at this point as to when that might be, and it's looking like it might not even be 2013. Probably, if it does happen this year, it would be toward the end of the year at the earliest. So maybe holiday time next year, there's a slight chance you could have a new Apple TV under the tree, but I'm guessing that it probably won't happen. I have to admit that when we started hearing rumors that Apple was doing a smaller version of the iPad, the 7-inch version, I was hesitant at best, and actually probably more if you go back and listen to this program. I was probably one of those people saying that it wasn't going to happen. I drank the Kool-Aid. I believed that Apple would never come out with a 7-inch tablet. But now that the Mini is here, it's proving to be one of Apple's most popular. As a matter of fact, when Apple launched the iPad Mini, it was believed that they had requested as many as 6 million units from suppliers for 2012. Well, recent comments by NPD display research analysts say that Apple may be planning to ship twice as many as that if they can get suppliers ramped up and build them fast enough. The success of the Mini has apparently outweighed even Apple's expectations. NPD display research says Apple is now working with their panel makers to double the original orders for the fourth quarter. So far, Apple has sold 42.8 million iPads in total this year for the first three quarters of 2012, and it's estimated that they may ship as many as 26 million iPads during this holiday quarter. That would be a record-setting 68.8 million units for this year. Looking into next year, NPD Display Research expects the iPad Mini shipments to reach over 100 million units, and they say that the iPad Mini is going to be the most popular, probably accounting for more than half of the units sold in 2013, so 50 million iPad Minis. That volume could prove pretty challenging for Apple, especially with their display manufacturers. Currently, they use AU Optronics and LG Display, who are both struggling to meet demand, so Apple's going to have to step it up a little bit. But the reality is there's only so many display manufacturers to go around, and Apple recently pulled its business from rival Samsung, and Apple's not the only tablet maker in the game, so there's a lot of other companies vying for that same business. Apple could be forced to rethink their decision on Samsung if demand for the iPad continues as it is. As a matter of fact, Display Research estimates that more than 170 million tablets will ship in 2013, and that Apple's iPads will account for about 60% of that market. So they're not going to be as big as they were in 2012, but they're still going to be the leader, at least according to Display Research, for the next year. And the good news for Apple is that many of those customers buying the iPad Mini look like they're new customers for Apple. Morgan Stanley and AlphaWise did a survey of 1,000 U.S. consumers this week and found that 34% of those planning to purchase a tablet said they plan to get an iPad Mini, and about half of those customers said that they were new to Apple. As a matter of fact, 47% of those planning to purchase a Mini claimed that that would be their first Apple product. On the full-size iPad front, about 56% of 9.7-inch iPad buyers said that that would be the device that brought them into the Apple fold. So, at least according to this study, it looks like rumors of iPad Mini cannibalizing iPad sales look to be a little bit overblown. But success of the Retina iPad and the iPad Mini is not going to stop the rumor sites from speculating when we'll see the next generation devices, nor what those will look like. There are rumors this week already that Apple is planning to update the next generation iPads and maybe doing it as early as the end of the first quarter of 2013. The Mini is expected to get a Retina update, but Apple will need to work out how to cram more pixels in there and increase processing without decreasing battery performance, a challenge that they're often faced with and something that they're going to have to figure out before they can release a new model. They're also going to have to figure out who's going to make those displays, as we were alluding to earlier. The Retina iPad is also reportedly going to get thinner and lighter, supposedly by Apple reducing the LED backlight in those models from 2 bars to 1. That creates a challenge for creating even lighting across the panel. So another thing that they're going to have to work out with display manufacturers. So will those updates come this spring? In the past, I would have immediately said no, but with the midterm update of the fourth generation iPad, I would say at this point, anything that Apple would do would not necessarily surprise me. Reports are claiming that the iPad Mini update, though, would happen in the fall, so a full year time frame. I'm hoping Apple moves back to that schedule, because the reality is if they start moving to bi-yearly or even tri-yearly updates of these products, I'm not sure my pocketbook could really take it. I guess I'd have to sort of rethink how quickly I upgrade to the next generation model. As was rumored, Google did release its version of its Maps application for iOS, something that was hotly anticipated by folks who had been disappointed by Apple's Map application in iOS 6. The Google Maps app does feature vector-based maps with 3D buildings, turn-by-turn directions, and transit maps, as well as Street View. Those last two things being features that I really missed when Google was no longer the map app in iOS. Google announced that the app was downloaded over 10 million times in the opening weekend, so lots of people grabbing that one. Obviously hotly anticipated, and there's already rumors that it's fueling larger adoption of iOS 6, meaning that some folks were holding off on upgrading just because of the Maps thing. I downloaded it almost immediately so I could take a look, and I have to say it is a nice update to the Google Maps. The one thing to note, though, is when you first launch it, it does request to collect personal information based on your location activity, and that option is defaulted to on. To turn it off, you need to actually click the box before saying okay. Now, some people actually missed that dialogue or just skipped through it in the excitement to get to the application. If you need to go back and turn it off later, turning it off is a little bit tricky. You actually need to go into the application's setting. You need to tap on the little person icon in the top right corner of the main screen. From there, you have to tap on the gear icon on the user profile screen, then you need to go into the About Terms and Privacy settings, and then into Terms and Privacy, and then from there you'll notice the location data collection option and you can turn it off. But I wanted to point that out because if you miss it during setup, it is a little bit tricky to get down and change that setting. And this was ultimately where Google wanted to go. And reportedly what we heard about in terms of how talks broke down between Google and Apple over the next generation maps in iOS 6 and why reportedly Apple went their own direction. Apple wanted access to the vector maps as well as the turn-by-turn directions. Google was holding that back, saying that they wanted access to more personal information and data from users, something that Apple wasn't willing to hand over. So now it looks like Google is getting what they wanted. Their application will collect that information, they say, anonymously, and that's how they're sort of working it. Google now reportedly does admit that the Maps application in iOS is better than the Android version, and they also say that they are working on an iPad version. Right now, the version that was released is just for iPhone only. It will be scaled up on the iPad, so it still runs on the iPad, but it's going to be that 2X version. There's another cool trick related to Google Maps that was reported by Mobile Nations. This is if you want to have Siri take you to Google Maps rather than the built-in Apple Maps. The one advantage Apple has with Apple Maps is that it's integrated across the entire OS. So when you tap on an address, say on a website, that's going to launch in Apple Maps, typically, if you ask Siri for directions, that's going to launch Apple Maps. But if you have Google Maps installed and you want Siri to take you right to Google Maps or actually any other routing application that supports transit directions, you can do this little trick. You can add the word via transit or by transit to the end of your instructions to Siri. So you can say, give me directions to the nearest Apple store by transit. And what will happen then is when she brings up the map, she will give you a list of the applications that you have installed that offer transit maps. And so you can tap on Google Maps or Navigon, some other application. And then when that pulls up and launches in your on your device, it will take you right to that application rather than the built-in maps. So that's pretty cool. And because Google has the transit directions and iOS 6 maps uses third-party transit applications to get transit directions, if you want transit directions from Apple Maps, when you tap on the transit button after having Google Maps installed, it comes up as a routing option and you can have Apple Maps launch the Google Maps, which is just a really interesting thing, but cool to see. So at the very least, it's worth having Google Maps installed on your device, even if it doesn't end up being your primary application, because it does bring things back like Street View and Transit Maps. We got details this week on Intel's next generation chips, codenamed Haswell. All but one of the models are Core i5 and Core i7 chip designs running quad cores and as many as 8 threads. The new chips also feature Intel's updated HD 4600 integrated graphics processor. On the upper end, there's a Core i7, the 4770K processor, which will be running at 3.5 gigahertz with 8 megabytes of cache. It also will use Intel's Turbo Boost technology and will max out at 3.9 gigahertz. The entire lineup has 6 different desktop processor designs, 2 of which are i7s. There's also 8 low-power chips in the Haswell lineup, the most powerful being a Core i7 running at 3.1 gigahertz that can surge up to 3.9 gigahertz with Turbo Boost. On the lower end of the low power chips, there's a Core i5 design running at 2.7 gigahertz with 6 megabytes of cache, 4 cores, and 4 threads. The chips should be out in 2013 and will likely show up in Apple's iMac and possibly MacBook lines when they go through their next updates. On the Mac Pro side, it's believed that Apple does have a significant update coming in early 2013, but for the Pro models, Apple generally uses Intel's server-grade processors like the Xeons, so I wouldn't expect the new Haswells to show up in that update. Looks like popularity of the iPhone 5 continues to grow in the U.S. despite a recent comment from UBS analyst Steve Mullinovich. He said that some of their Chinese sources did not expect the iPhone 5 to do as well as the iPhone 4S, but the iPhone seems to be contradicting that trend, at least among U.S. consumers, where its popularity has continued to grow since its launch. Gene Munster recently did a survey of 800 prospective U.S. smartphone purchasers and found that 53% of respondents say they are planning to buy an iPhone 5. That number is actually up from 48% in a similar survey conducted prior to the launch of the iPhone. The study also noted that interest in Android dropped from 39% to 35.2% over the same period. Munster said that demand for the iPhone 5 is up 36% compared with demand for the iPhone 4S over the same period last year. Apple also launched the iPhone 5 in China, along with 32 additional countries last week, and announced on Monday that they had sold over 2 million in the opening weekend of sales in the region. That is a new record for an iPhone launch in China. Apple this week quickly released an update to its new iTunes 11 software. iTunes 11.0.1 update came out, and it does return the show duplicates feature that was missing from the new version. I'm very glad to see that back in there, although you might have a little bit of trouble finding it. Apple actually moved it. It's now found under the View menu. Previously, you would find it under the File menu. In addition, the update also brings improved search performance if you have a large library. It fixes an issue where new purchases in iCloud wouldn't show up in libraries with iTunes Match enabled, and also addresses a bug where the AirPlay button did not appear as expected. You can grab the update by running Software Update from the App Store app or through Apple's website at apple.com/support. iTunes 11 did bring some pretty big user interface changes. We've talked about those a little bit on the show. One of the most significant ones is that it uses that new one window interface, and that was a big change for a lot of us, but I got an email from a visually impaired MacCast listener who pointed out that these kinds of changes can be even more impactful on users who rely on the accessibility features in these different applications. He told me that he kind of had to grope his way around to find out how to re-enable the sidebar and the table list views, and he mentioned that, you know, similar issues came up when Apple did the updates, the big user interface updates to applications like Messages and Contacts. And he explained to me that the big thing here is that when Apple changes the UI like this, it can have even more significant impacts on how things like keyboard navigation work. And that's something that visually impaired users definitely rely on to work their way around the different applications. So it was a very interesting perspective and something that a lot of sighted users like myself normally wouldn't think of. I mean, we talk about our challenges with user interface changes, but imagine if you couldn't even see the screen, the kinds of adjustments that need to be made. So I guess we're all in that situation where we have quite a bit of a learning curve to go through with iTunes 11. Some additional updates that came out this week. Apple also released an update to Macs to fix a Wi-Fi issue. Mac Wi-Fi Update 1.0 was released for all late 2012 Macs. The update will supposedly improve compatibility when using the 5 GHz band. You do need to be running OS 10 at 10.8.2 and have one of the new Auto iMacs to get that update. In addition, they also released an update to the MacBook Pro Retina EFI Update version 1.1. Again, this is for the late 2012 models of the 13-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display. It improves sleep performance, enhances support for Thunderbolt, fixes an HDMI issue, and improves compatibility again with the 5 GHz band in Wi-Fi. You do need to be running macOS 10 10.8.1 or newer to get this update, as well as have a new 13-inch MacBook Pro. All of those updates, of course, are available through running Software Update or on Apple's website at apple.com/support. If you've been listening to the show over the last couple months, you know that there is a lot of speculation, rumor, and just sort of discussion about what Apple is going to do in terms of their custom chips, not only iOS chips, but also potentially making processors for the Mac. I had been talking about it a little bit on the show, and one of the companies that's been thrown around as a potential partner for doing fabrication for Apple since they're trying to move away from Samsung is Intel. I got some great feedback from a former Intel executive this past week who speculates that it may make a lot of sense for Apple to go with Intel as a fab partner, even more so than even I was thinking. I had kind of thought that since Intel has its own mobile processors, that they would try and sort of push Apple to using those in future iOS devices, but my source gave me some additional information that makes a whole lot of sense. He says that semiconductor manufacturing is basically a really high fixed cost business, and that most of those costs are tied up in the plant and manufacturing, and that when there's extra capacity, that extra capacity, and he suspects that Intel probably has it, is mostly profit if they can use it. In addition, he says that Apple really does have a lot of leverage with Intel since they're currently the source for Apple's Mac processors. We know that from other rumors that Apple is looking to move away from Samsung in the fabrication of those iOS processors, and what could happen is they could play Intel and Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation off of each other. That is the other company rumored to be a potential source for doing AX processor fabrication. My source points out that Apple has a history of sort of playing companies against each other. If you remember, they had OS X running on x86 processors for years before they made the switch to Intel, and it's pretty well known that they used to use that as a threat against IBM in the PowerPC days to get better deals, saying that, hey, if you don't do what we want, we can just move over to Intel. We already have OS X running over there, and that of course, history has proven, is eventually what did happen. Intel would love to see Apple switch to Intel's mobile processors, but that probably isn't going to happen. What's more likely is that Apple is going to use the threat of moving Macs off of Intel to Apple's own chips that they would fab themselves, say with a company like TSMC, as leverage to get Intel to produce the AX processors for them at a really good deal. I believe that Apple already has at least some Mac prototype designs running on AX processors, but that's pure speculation on my part. Intel could come out, though, as a big winner in all of this because they could use their extra manufacturing capacity to help Apple get more business and make more money. As a matter of fact, Bob Cringely has a really nice piece that kind of lays this out and follows the same logic. I'll link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But I thought both of these comments provided a really interesting and very insightful perspective. Again, all speculative at this point. And the reality is based on some of the numbers I'm seeing and the demand for iOS devices, it could be that it turns out both Intel and TSMC end up with some of Apple's contracts for the A6 production or AX production. In recent weeks, there's also been this buzz going that Apple is planning on going fully in-house and building their own facility to do chip fabrication, or probably more realistically, partnering with someone to build a new facility that would do production exclusively for Apple. The project is reportedly codenamed Azalea, and supposedly Apple and whoever their partner is using that project to shop around different locations to build a new fabrication facility. One of those places that's been rumored is New York. They supposedly have been pitching building a 3.2 million square foot facility in the state. And a reporter recently asked New York Governor Cuomo if Apple was one of the companies that they were pitching that to. He basically responded by saying that they were pitching to a lot of companies and that Apple would have a lot of competition for that location. Definitely not a definitive answer, but seemed to allude that Apple might be looking to build a facility. Then this week, the Business Economic Development Agency in Oregon announced that they were recruiting a company codenamed Azalea to build a chip facility in their state. The Oregonian said that the contract facility would be there to build Apple's iOS processors. I think the likely scenario is that Apple is getting into the fab business in one way or another, and that they may be helping a partner build a U.S. factory somewhere, and that that partner is the one shopping around different locations looking for the best deal. Currently, Apple makes their iOS processors in a Samsung facility in Texas, and that has also been another state rumored to be being looked at for the Azalea project. So the rumors are pretty strong that the project is happening and that Apple is likely involved. The big question is who is their partner? Intel actually already has fabrication facilities in Oregon. TSMC, they have facilities through a subsidiary company called WaferTech in Washington State, but that location is just about 20 miles from Portland, Oregon, so both of those are very likely candidates to be Apple's partner. A couple other companies that Apple currently doesn't partner with but also seem like likely choices would be Global Foundries, Inc. They're actually the world's second largest independent semiconductor foundry after TSMC, and they do currently have facilities in New York, so that would make sense for potentially a New York location. Also, Freescale Semiconductor, they have facilities in Texas. Again, not a current Apple partner. As a matter of fact, in the past, Apple's had some lawsuits with them. And in 2011, Apple actually purchased the rights to about 200 of Freescale's patents. So any one of those companies could be it. I think the likely choices at this point are Intel or TSMC. They're probably involved in this project, and they're probably shopping those various locations to build a fabrication facility, probably exclusively for Apple. I think without a doubt, Apple is using its influence, its bankroll, and its big contract deals to kind of pit Intel and TSMC against each other, and we'll see who is going to give Apple the best deal, and that's likely who they've ended up picking for this project. And with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. Notebook is a great application for taking notes, for doing research, for creating outlines. It's also great for doing lists, to-do lists, anything that you might need to keep track of. Great for gift lists this time of year. Also, thank you lists, all those people that send you those great gifts. You want to make sure you remember what they sent you and get out thank you cards. You can make a list there in Circus Ponies for that. Also, Christmas card lists. If you need to get those Christmas cards sent out, you can use Notebook to help you do that. As a matter of fact, you can drop in contacts, and when you do that, you have full access to all of their contact details from a little sticker over there in the margin. So you have no need to launch the contact application. You can get access to a phone number. You know, a phone call is always nice this time of year, and you can organize everybody that you want to get in contact with inside Notebook. And that's really just one small feature out of a dozen features, dozens of great features, really, that are in Notebook. It's a truly versatile application. I think once you get it, you'll find more and more uses for it, so you definitely get your money's worth. And what's great is they have a free 30-day trial on their website, so you can try before you buy. Just head to circusponies.com and download it today. You'll be glad you did. And a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their support of the MacCast. So I'm continuing to explore iTunes 11, and I think you are as well, and I continue to get a lot of comments and questions about it. One thing someone pointed out to me is that the download list, I think we talked about the fact that with the new user interface, a lot of the modal dialog windows go away. So you used to have that dialog download window that you could pull up and you could see all of the different downloads that you did, and it was sort of constantly there available for you to look at. Well, that has gone away and now has been replaced with this little cloud icon that appears in the upper right-hand corner of the interface, I guess, and it's a little drop-down list. You click on the icon, it'll drop down, it'll show you what's currently downloading. So if you're downloading purchases or podcasts or something like that, they'll show up. But something about that little icon is that it's only there when you're actually doing a download. So that can be a little bit confusing for people going, hey, where did that download list go? And that's where it is, and you'll only see it when you're actually downloading. Another thing related to that is that the changes to the mini player mean that you no longer get any download status in the mini player when something's going on. So once again, you remember, you used to be able to click on the little LCD panel and sort of flip through what was happening in the mini player and see, hey, I'm doing an app update download in the background there. That is no longer available in the mini player. Listener Bob actually wanted to know if there's a trick to re-enable it. As far as I know, there isn't. I think that feature is just gone. Apple did not bring it back in the iTunes 11.0.1 update, as far as I know. So probably the best way to get that feature back in there would be to provide some feedback, Bob. Just go to apple.com/feedback and you can give your opinion there. If any of you do know that if there is a trick or a third-party application to kind of bring back that feature, let us know. Shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing that several people have emailed me about is the fact that they can't seem to change the music kind on some of their files in iTunes 11. As a matter of fact, Bob mentioned this in his email as well. He said he currently uses the feature to record internet radio streams and turn them into podcasts. Just a quick aside, the application that he uses for that, well, he used to use the Griffin Radio Shark. Those of us who've been around for a while probably remember this thing. It was a hardware device that Griffin sold. Little thing that looked like a shark fin. It was actually an antenna. I think it hooked up on USB and would allow you to capture terrestrial radio streams or radio stations and record them on your Mac. So he was using that for a while. He then recently, shifted over to Radio Shift, which was a great application from Rogue Amoeba that would allow you to schedule and record internet radio streams, or actually anything that you could stream online. And it was cool because you could just go to your local radio station if they offered like a flash stream. A lot of that stuff was in flash streaming radio. And you could schedule Radio Shift to record and capture that, put it into an MP3. Unfortunately, they no longer have that application in development. But if you're looking for something to actually capture radio streams, Rogue Amoeba still does sell Audio Hijack Pro, and Piezo both offer the ability to capture and record audio streams on your Mac. And as a matter of fact, Audio Hijack Pro can do the scheduling of recordings and things like that. I've used that in the past to actually capture internet radio streams when I'm in bed, or, you know, when it's in odd hours. The problem with radio, unlike podcasts, right, is that you have to be there when it's running live in many cases. And if you aren't, then an application like Audio Hijack Pro or Piezo can come in really handy. But sort of back to what Bob was doing, so he's capturing these audio streams and then taking them and turning them into podcasts so that he could sync them over to his devices and also get the advantage of resumed playback and stuff like that. What he noticed was, now that he's moved to iTunes 11, he suddenly can't do that anymore. What happens is you select the track in iTunes, you choose Get Info, you go to that Options tab, and under the Media Kind section, everything is grayed out. You actually can't switch between it. So I was doing a little research into what was going on here, Bob, and at least part of the issue seems like it might be related to iTunes Match being enabled. And I confirmed this on my system. When I had iTunes Match turned on, I could not access the Media Kind options, but if I turned it off completely, then suddenly, at least for some of my tracks, not all of them, and I haven't figured out why some and why not some, but at least for some of them, I was able to change the Media Kind. Now, several people mentioned that even in doing this, they couldn't get the Media Kind to stick. So even though the option became available, when they would click OK, it wouldn't stay on that type. In my case, I think I was able to change it. At least it seemed to stick for me. But definitely there is a problem here, and several people are reporting it. It's actually there's some discussion threads on Apple's support website. Now, interestingly, some people noted that they were able to change the Media Kind to audiobook, just not any other format. And that may be related to whether or not the source file is in AAC. As a matter of fact, some users have reported success in converting files from the AAC or the .m4a format over to MP3 files, and they said that when they do that, they suddenly get that Media Kind option to come back and start working again. So I'm not sure I have a definitive fix for you here, Bob, but at least there's a couple things to try. If any of you have run across this issue and come up with a definitive solution, please send me an email and let me know what you figured out, because I wasn't able to figure this one out, at least not 100%. And then finally, in iTunes 11, I got a good little tip from Ty. I don't even think this is necessarily iTunes 11 related, but if you're like me and Ty, many of you purchase movies and you get the digital copy. That's the little code that often comes with the DVD, and you can take that and you can plug it into iTunes, and then you end up with a digital version online. Well, I think a few months back, maybe earlier in the year, Apple started enabling it so that their movie downloads, the re-downloads of purchase content, you could also get access to some of the digital content. It used the digital copy content. It used to be in the past that digital copies didn't fall in line or didn't fall under your purchased items or your previously purchased items in iTunes. Apple started changing that, at least with some studios, but what Ty found was that when he moved to iTunes 11, when he went to his purchased list, not all of his movies were showing up, and specifically a lot of the digital copy movies that he had enabled weren't showing up in his previous purchases. So he was messing around with it a little bit, and what he found was that if he re-entered the code, basically re-downloaded the digital copies using the original codes, suddenly some of the movies would start to show up in his purchased content. Now, I don't think all studios allow re-downloads, so that may be a factor here. Another thing that might be going on, or another thing to be aware of, is that very often the digital copy codes have a time limit, so you may not be able to re-enable or re-download all of those digital copies. But if you do have some of them and you're noticing, hey, my digital copies aren't showing up in my previous purchases, it's something worth looking into. And thanks, Ty, for that tip. Joe has been having an issue with his iOS device in iTunes. Basically, he shot me an email and he said that he's been trying to cable sync his device and keeps getting an error message saying that it can't sync because his content isn't authorized. Now, of course, his content is authorized. It's purchased content, but he couldn't figure out how to get past this error message. Joe, typically in these instances, what I usually recommend is doing or trying a couple different things. One would be deauthorizing iTunes and authorizing it again. So if you go under the store menu and you're already authorized, you should see an option that says deauthorize this computer. Go ahead and select that. That's going to deauthorize iTunes. And then you can go back into that store menu and you'll notice that option has changed to authorize. Select that option. You'll need to plug in your iTunes store ID credentials. And then when you do that, you should be reauthorized. So you can try that. Another thing you can do is you can try going into the store. So go over to the iTunes store, click on your email address, basically accessing your account under the toolbar, and choose log out. So just log out of the iTunes store and log back in. Sometimes that'll sort of rejigger things and get you reauthorized. The other thing to try would be to simply restart iTunes and also restart your device. So hold down the home and the sleep wake button at the same time till it completely reboots. Don't do the power off thing. I mean, you could try the power off thing, but I think just doing a hard reset works a little bit better. So hold those down until the device completely resets and then reconnect it and see if that doesn't fix things up. Now, a little confession here. I actually already emailed Joe these tips and he sent me back an email saying none of these tricks worked for him, and then said that he did get it fixed by actually trashing his iTunes preference file, his plist file. For those of you who don't know where that is, if you go into your home folder, into the library folder, and if you're running OS X Lion or later, you're probably going to have to go under the Go menu while you hold down the Option key to get access to the library folder. But go into the library folder under Preferences, and then you're going to be looking for a file called com.apple.com.itunes.plist. That is the preference file for iTunes. That is the one Joe removed to fix this situation. Just be aware that when you delete that file, you're deleting your iTunes preferences, so you're going to have to go back in and reset up any preferences, but if it gets your syncing back working, that's probably a better result and worth the little inconvenience of having to reset up some preferences. Now, something Joe told me is that while he was in there doing that, he noticed a bunch of odd files or unusual files in the preference list there. He found a bunch of extra iTunes.plist files with a little strange alphanumeric string at the end of them, and all of them were 0 bytes. There were also some iTunes preference.lock files in that preference folder, and he was wondering what those were, and two, were those something that he could safely delete? And interestingly, the ones with the little cryptic strings on the end are Apple's attempt to avoid the kind of situation that Joe had to deal with, the plist corruption, you know, where your preference file gets corrupt and causes some sort of problem. These files can actually all be safely removed. The lock files, you're probably not going to have much luck in removing because the next time you launch iTunes, they're just going to get recreated. So you don't generally have to worry about those too much. But these little 0-byte temporary plist files, those certainly can be removed. It's just a little protection thing. Obviously, it didn't work in your case, Joe, but you'll see them pop up from time to time. There shouldn't be a ton of them. I would imagine if you're seeing a lot of them, like in Joe's case, that's indication that there's some sort of problem going on. I looked in my home folder and I only had one of those little files, so I just removed it if you want to clean things up. But again, they're not taking up any storage, so it doesn't even really hurt to have them there. And I guess the past few episodes, we've been having this sort of theme where a lot of people are having a situation where updates are getting stuck or something's getting stuck in their system and they go into this perpetual loop. If you remember, last time we had somebody who was having issues with the iPhoto update and the App Store app basically telling him, hey, you need to update your iTunes. He'd run the update and verify that his iTunes was up to date with the latest version. Then the next time he'd launch the App Store, it'd tell him, hey, you have an update available again, and was stuck in this perpetual cycle. Now, I had recommended on that episode that the way the App Store works is it uses the Spotlight database to determine if an application is up to date. And so I recommended basically rebuilding the Spotlight database. Well, a couple of people wrote in to tell me that that doesn't always work, and that another thing that you might want to check is your App Store cache. And you could use a cache cleaning tool like Onyx or Cocktail to clean out your user caches, or more specifically your system caches, probably both, which is usually what I do. But there's also a terminal command that you can run that I ran across that may prove helpful if you've run into this problem. Basically, you want to go in, you want to launch terminal, so go into Applications, Utilities, and launch the terminal application. Then you're going to type the command open, space, and then dollar sign, and in all caps, temp directory, /c/. And that is going to open up a special directory, and then in there, in the Finder, you can look for and delete the com.apple.appstore folder, which is the cache for the App Store. And try relaunching that and see if that doesn't clear out that sort of stuck application update that's going on. So you can give that a try. If you're not comfortable with the terminal, again, you probably want to use a cache cleaning tool. But then also I received an email related to this topic from Michael, who reminded me that another source and potential cause of this issue could be your backups. Now, MacCast listeners, we all back up, right? You know, because I'm constantly hounding you about it. And particularly, you probably have a clone backup using something like SuperDuper or Cocktail, or Carbon Copy Cloner, excuse me. And if you're doing that, then chances are that that external drive is also being indexed by Spotlight. And so what can happen is that you could update the main version of the application, but because the App Store uses your Spotlight database, it may be picking up the older version that is in your backup, and that's the one it's telling you that you need to update, but you're just not realizing it. So what you might want to do is have Spotlight not index or ignore your backup drives so that you don't end up in this situation. And so if you want to do that, what you could do is you can launch System Preferences, go into the Spotlight Preferences, and then click on the Privacy tab. Then down there at the bottom, you'll see a little plus icon. You can click that, and then you can choose your disk or a specific folder that you want Spotlight to not index or ignore and add that to the list. If you're doing Time Machine backups as well as clone backups, you might also want to do this for your Time Machine volumes. Just be aware that if you do, though, that Spotlight is not going to index Time Machine, and therefore when you go into the Time Machine interface and want to do a search, stuff isn't going to show up. But in general, I found that indexing backup volumes can cause different little quirkiness and problems. Doing things like if you right-click on a file or a document and choose Open With, sometimes you'll see double applications, if you've ever noticed that. That's because the Launch Services database is picking up applications from your cloned backups and things like that. So I generally, at the very least, have my clone backups ignored, and I don't even mind not being able to search Time Machine, so I actually have it also ignore my Time Machine volumes. So that might be another reason why these App Store updates are appearing even though you've already updated the application. Another thing we talked about on the last MacCast was the update to the iWork applications for iOS, and specifically the fact that Apple has finally brought the track changes feature to Pages in iOS, and that may mean that more people can actually use Pages on iOS as a Word solution or a solution for working with Word documents, because many people rely on that feature. But the one question I had in that program was when I went and used the feature, and I don't use track changes all that frequently, I wasn't really sure that it had all of the features and functionality that most people would need, specifically people who work heavily with Microsoft Word documents, in terms of how it handled track changes and how you were able to accept and approve changes and things like that. So I asked for some feedback from you, and John chimed in. He said he uses track changes a lot with MS Word 2011 on the Mac, and he did some quick testing for us. So I wanted to share some of his observations with all of you. He said, basically, when he opened his Word document, the first thing that popped up was a font substitution. It's pretty well known that when you're working with documents on iOS, you don't have access to all of the same fonts. So in his case, he had a document that was using Times New Roman. It popped up and said, you know what, this font isn't available on iOS, but is it okay if we replace it? Or I think it actually just said it replaced it with Times New Roman PSMT. He said it did that, and the document actually looked really good on the iPad. So that really didn't pose that big of a problem for him. But just be aware, if you're working with Word documents that are using a lot of custom fonts, it might not look exactly the same when you get it onto the iPad. But getting back to the track changes stuff, he did note that changes appear inline on Pages on the iPad, which is a little bit different than how they appear with Pages on the Mac. On the Mac side, you actually have a little sidebar. They're off to the side and they're not displayed inline. He said that it's actually more helpful to kind of have them in line, but he did note that on the iPad, it does not indicate who made the changes or when the changes were made. And that's something, an additional information that is really handy to have. And that was one of the first things that I noticed, was that it doesn't show you who made the changes. So if you have to approve or reject them, it could be a little bit confusing, especially if you're working collaboratively on a document with more than one person. The other thing that John noted that could be challenging if you're working with track changes on the iPad is that it doesn't distinguish between comments, insertions, deletions, and formatting changes. So Pages and Microsoft Word on the Mac side will indicate those things to you. On the iPad, that information isn't available. So again, makes it a little bit harder to work with. So at the moment, it looks like at least having track changes in there is a good start, but there's definitely room for improvement. John said it's likely good for viewing a document that has changes in it, but actually working with it, editing it, approving or rejecting those changes is probably still better done and more functional with Pages or Microsoft Word on the desktop, where it's a little bit better experience. So thanks, John, for sending in that feedback. If you've been working with track changes and have a different opinion or similar opinions, feel free to share those with us. You can shoot me email to maccast@gmail.com. With the recent updates to the iMac and Mac Mini lines, also some new laptops out there, a very common question that I'll get from a lot of you is about the processors that are in these units. A lot of times the processors are very similar, just slight changes in the clock speed. So say a 2.5 gigahertz processor versus a 2.7 gigahertz processor, but going from one model to another or custom ordering a faster processor costs a couple $100. So a very common question when new systems come out is it worth it for me to spend a couple $100 to get, say, 0.2 gigahertz extra processor? And my answer is, it depends. I know a lot of people are generally looking for a definitive answer, but let me go into a little bit more detail and give you a specific example. So let's look at, say, the new Mac Mini. Its base model is $599. It comes with a 2.5 gigahertz Core i5 processor. And then for $200 more at the $799 price point, you can get a 2.3 gigahertz Core i7. And you might be going, wait a minute, that's slower clock speed for more money. But you need to dive into the details. And this is where that it depends situation comes into play. The big difference is that the i5 on the base model is a dual core processor, whereas the i7 is a quad core. So you're going to end up with little slower clock speed, but more cores. Now, more cores are good and are going to yield better performance if you have software that's going to take advantage of it. So the trick is knowing, do I have applications that can take advantage of more cores, and will more cores give me a significant speed bump? These days, most applications are written to take advantage of multiple cores. So in general, if you can get more cores in your processor, that is going to be a worthwhile upgrade. Now, let's contrast that with the new iMacs. All of the new iMacs feature quad-core i5 processors. Their clock speeds range from 2.7 gigahertz up to 3.2 gigahertz, and there is a couple $100 price difference between the different models. So, again, for example, if you look at the 2.7 gigahertz 21.5-inch model versus the 2.9 gigahertz one, there's a $200 price difference. In my opinion, though, there, in that case, your money would be better spent on doubling the amount of RAM, say, in the 2.7 gigahertz model, going from 8 gigabytes to 16 gigabytes, because you have a Core i5 and you really just have a 0.2 gigahertz difference in the processor, which for most people is not going to be a significant speed bump. You're going to get much more performance increase, or a better performance increase, out of increasing your RAM. You could also take the money and put it towards an SSD or a Fusion drive. You're going to have to bump up to the higher end base model, because the base 21.5-inch doesn't offer those build to order upgrades. But again, I think your money's better spent if you're looking at the same number of cores in your processor in other areas. If you've already maxed everything else out and you just want to eke a little bit more performance out of that, then upgrading to a faster clock speed processor in the same line could provide a little bit of benefit. But again, it's not the most bang for your buck. So that's just my opinion. If you have some thoughts on the issue, please send us some feedback. And then finally today, a cool trick that was sent to me, actually a little reminder that I got via email from Andrew. This is a trick that I actually have used for iOS applications, but in his case, he was talking about using it with iWork documents. And what this trick does is essentially let you extract different assets or different elements that are embedded within different kinds of documents or applications. In this case, specifically iWork documents, things like Pages and Keynote. I also assume this would work with Numbers, but I haven't actually tried it in that. But when you go look at those files in the operating system, in the Finder, they look like individual files. But what they actually are little packages or these kind of special folders. And they contain all the little bits and pieces that go into making up the document. Now, you might be aware of this sort of analogy with applications. If you've ever control-clicked or right-clicked on an application in your applications folder, you can see that you have an option that says Show Package Contents. And if you select that option, you can browse through and you can see all of the stuff contained inside that application. Now, if you do this, I recommend that you only do these tricks on copies, because if you mess up anything inside these little packages, you could corrupt the document or corrupt the application. So make a copy if you're going to play around with this. But you can control-click or right-click, use the Show Package Contents option on an application, and you can see things like the icon files and image files, and there's a bunch of neat stuff in there, so it's kind of fun to poke around with. But you'll notice if you try this trick on a Pages file, for example, you don't get the Show Package Contents option. It does appear to be just a file. Now, the trick that Andrew pointed out and that he reminded me of that comes into play is that if you take that same file, say a .pages file, and change the extension from .pages to .zip, you will end up with a compressed and archived file, a zip file, that you can then decompress. And when you do that, it ends up becoming a folder. And then when you have that folder, you can go inside there and you can then see all of the different elements. And so why would you want to do this? Well, one of the big reasons, and the one that Andrew was using it for, was he had some video files that were embedded inside a Keynote document, and he wanted to get access back to those source video files. So using this trick, he could go in there and he could see the original videos that were embedded. And at that point, then you can just simply drag them out. This is also very useful for grabbing images. I've done it with applications, specifically iOS applications, to get screenshots and different image files, start screen image files out so that I could use them as album art in my podcast. So the way this trick works with mobile application files, or the little .ipa files for applications in iOS, is you go into your iTunes folder, you go into mobile applications, and you'll see all of the .ipa files. Again, make a copy of that IPA file, drag it out to the desktop or something like that, and then change the IPA extension to .zip. Then double-click on it, let it extract, and then go into the folder, and you'll find the application file for that iOS app. It'll have a .app extension. At that point, you can control-click or right-click on that, and you'll notice you'll get the Show Package Contents option. Then you can drill into that individual application and get at all of its little goodies. So this is kind of a fun little one to play around with. Try it out, and thanks, Andrew, for sending that tip along. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out the software as well as get more information and details and a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch for iOS. You can get more information and details on their software as well as free trials of the Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, find out what your old gadgets are worth, your iPhone, your iPad. If you want to get quick cash, you can do that over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. If you have a question, a comment, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype name is The MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. Also check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/themaccast. And we now have a new Google Plus community. So you can find me on Google Plus, or you can find the community on Google Plus at MacCast. And look forward to seeing you online. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.